Thank you, Sue. Welcome to the Court of Appeals on the first day of fall, September 22. I'll ask the marshal to introduce the panel, please.
The Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Sleater, Judge Kirk, and Judge Cochran. The Honorable Randall J. Sleater presiding.
And we have five matters this morning for our consideration, all oral. The first matter is file A210401, Old Republic Surety Company, which is the respondent, Mark Bugney et al. Appellants. And counsel, I'm assuming you're by now aware, we do everything pretty much the same, except we're remote, of course. And so appellants counsel will have 15 minutes to argue, 15 minutes for respondents counsel, if you wish, and then 5 minutes of rebuttal for appellant, if you desire. You'll see the clock as you see it in the corner. So the marshal will make sure to time it appropriately, and you can see it. If for any reason we lose anyone from a technological standpoint, he knows to stop the time until we get reconnected. No one is allowed to record these proceedings, but the judicial branch will have a recording of it available on its judicial branch website within 24 hours. And so with that in mind, counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself for our record and proceed, please.
Good morning, Your Honor. Greg Miller of the law firm of Greg Miller Law Office, appearing on behalf of both Mark Bugney and Beth Troutman, who I note are appearing without video this morning. May it please the court, and I apologize, I'm seated. I've never addressed a court in Minnesota seated before, so I'll try not to fidget and gesticulate wildly to make up for it.
That's fine. And Mr. Miller, you may want to just speak up a little bit. I had a little bit of a hard time, but I don't know if that's just me or the others. But if you're able to get a little closer to your microphone, that would be great. Thank you.
Is this better, Your Honor?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Okay. I'll try to speak up as well. May it please the court. This appeal was taken from an order by Judge Abrams, wherein us as the appellants believe that a significant error of law was made in the granting of summary judgment in favor of Old Republic. It is based upon a couple things, and I know both parties have submitted substantive briefs to the court, so I'm not going to regurgitate all that's in our briefs, but I am going to try to illuminate a couple of points for the court that I believe are really the important, the crux of this matter. And that is, what is the obligation of the indemnitors in this particular case? We have a document that is the only document that was signed by Mr. Bugney and Ms. Troutman. It was an application for a bond. It is the sole instrument signed by the indemnitors, and it is the agreement by which the indemnitors agreed to participate in this bonding structure. So that is the document, that is the agreement, that's the only thing that's been signed. It is not a bond. It is simply an application for a bond that includes indemnity language, and it was signed by both of my clients who are appealing today. The reason that it is important that that is the only instrument that was signed by them is because the bond that was applied for clearly is a one-year bond commencing on July 1st, 2011 and continuing thereafter for a single year. The application, for reasons unknown to me or my clients, the application was in November of 2011, but nonetheless, it is quite clear that it was applying for a bond that would commence on the first day of July, 2011. So for some reason it was done retroactively, I don't understand it, but in any event, it was a one-year document. It says so on its face.
Now, Mr. Miller, can I ask you that? What I noticed from the briefing is that your brief spends less time on the bond itself, and respondent's brief spends less time on the application for obvious reasons. But I'm trying to get an understanding of the correlation between the two. But paragraph number four on the front page of the bond for which your client's indemnification relates to indicates effective date on July 1, 2011. So that would mirror the application and shall remain in effect until the earlier expiration of the principal's license as the collection agency or cancellation of the bond by the surety. So, and there's no cancellation to my understanding in the record. So how does that make the language seems to conflict with the language in the application, which is 1 year. What do we make of that? And also my follow-up question is, the judge seemed to indicate both parties thought there was no fact issues in dispute and used in multiple places that there were several extensions.
Well, and that is really the crux of my argument, that we didn't sign the bond. The bond isn't the agreement between the indemnitors and the surety. The application is the agreement between the indemnitors and the surety. And we cited to the Travertine case, as did Old Republic cite to the Travertine case, which basically says, if you have the language that you need on the face of the agreement, you have the agreement. And so in this particular case, the agreement, quote unquote, is the application for the bond. The bond came later at some point, and it was signed by Weinerman and Associates, but it was not signed by either of the indemnitors. And I'll tell you why that is super important. And we even included this in the addendum, but it is really the affidavit of plaintiff that was submitted in support of the motion for summary judgment. It's addendum page 29, and it is paragraph 12 on page 3 of that affidavit. And this is the vice president of Old Republic saying this, that the agreement shows WA Weinerman and Associates applied for a 1 year term bond. So they're acknowledging on the face of that application, it was a 1 year term bond that was applied for. So now here's why that's super important, is the admission that's in paragraph 16. It says halfway through that paragraph, had the bond not been renewed several times, it would not have been in effect at the time plaintiff sent the cancellation. Plaintiff would not have any reason to send the notice of cancellation. They acknowledge in this affidavit that that bond would have had to have been renewed to be, quote unquote, in effect. So now we know that there were no payouts under that first year bond from July 1st, 2011, through June 30th of 2012. We know that there were no payouts based upon that 1 year application. They admit it was a 1 year application, and they admit that the bond would not be in effect unless it was renewed, as they say it, several times. So now we have to ask ourselves, was there any evidence submitted to the court that the bond was renewed? Well, the answer to that is unequivocally no. And how do we know that? Because if you look at also in our addendum, it is addendum page 17. It is also attached to the affidavits of my client, but it is encaptioned surety bond. It looks exactly like the bond that was issued in 2011, except in paragraph 4, it says this bond shall become effective on July 1st, 2014. Now, the payouts that were made in 2016 were made pursuant to this last bond. The events of 2014 is what led to the payouts in 2016 with the state and Old Republic. So this would have been the bond renewal that would have been effective should there be claims made. And what we have here is something that I found exceptionally alarming and pointed it out to the trial court. The trial court found it less alarming, but if you notice, this instrument is notarized. It's notarized on the first day of July, 2014, State of Iowa, County of Polk. Catherine Stewart is the notary for Old Republic. And in this acknowledgement, it's not signed. There is no signature there. We have an unsigned, notarized, J.C. Whitlock was supposed to sign it. I guess this harks back to the robo-signing in the mortgage world a few years ago. But we don't have, all we have is a notary stamp, and we don't have the signature of Mr. Whitlock. We also don't have it signed by Weinerman and Associates. And so at no time do the indemnitors countersign any bond or any extension of any bond. We don't know the terms of any extension of any bond. And should they have changed from the original application that was signed by the indemnitors, It is venerated law in Minnesota that if terms are modified or changed, a guarantor can be relieved of their obligations to guarantee an obligation that is modified without their consent. In this particular case, this is clearly not countersigned. It's not signed by anybody, but let alone, I kept expecting, I read all of the demand collection letters that came to my client, the complaint that came, the submissions for summary judgment. I kept expecting to see something that would support the A, that a renewal actually happened of the bond, but B, that there was some sort of consent of the indemnitors or they were separately provided notice, all of the things that I'm accustomed to when I'm doing loan packages or debt instruments. And I didn't see any of it in this case. All I saw was a very alarming notarized document that does not bear a signature. We're not plaintiffs, we're the defendants. The burden is squarely on Old Republic to demonstrate that they're entitled to a claim against the indemnitors. They did not sue Weinerman Associates. They didn't sue the principals of Weinerman Associates. They sued the indemnitor with whom they only have a single agreement. And in that agreement, they make admissions in that affidavit that the agreement shows WA applied for 1 year term bond and that the bond would not be in effect unless it had been renewed several times. So that's the evidence that absolutely must be before the court. So,
Mr. Miller, yes. I'll go ahead, Judge Cochran.
No, you follow up. I'll ask an additional question if you don't cover what I was thinking of. Thank you.
I just wanted to clarify. You're welcome. Mr. Miller, then just to clarify, is the only evidence the court had in its record to find there was no fact dispute, but that it had been extended, is this unsigned 2014 document, as well as the affidavit, I believe, of an officer, perhaps of a respondent's counsel.
That is
a client. I'm sorry.
Sorry, Your Honor. Yes, that is the sum total of the record that could support anything relative to a renewal. And, you know, 56.03 says specifically, if you want summary judgment, you have to cite two specific documents in the record, evidence in the record, and simply saying it was renewed and only producing an unsigned document. I don't think that bears plaintiff's burden of proof in this case, certainly not for a summary judgment. And so that's why you see me try to walk a very thin line saying, if my argument is true, there are no facts that are necessary that are in dispute. We can determine based upon what is properly before the court, this is insufficient evidence. They didn't bear their burden and summary judgment in favor of defendants. Not so with the plaintiff. If the court says, well, there's some information here, there's an affidavit, it conflicts in on itself, and frankly, it makes damning admissions, but, you know, maybe there's an obligation here, then that is not appropriate for summary judgment and should proceed to trial. But my plain argument here, the unjust enrichment case has to fail because as a premise, it has to be unjust. And it's simply not unjust here when we have indemnitors that are signing on the face of the document for 1 year. That's what they believe themselves to be signing to. And at the end of that 1 year, there's no evidence that it was renewed. There's no counter signatures on any of the surety bonds. There isn't a signature on any extension of the bond, and they admit that it would have had to have happened. So I'll reserve the rest of the time unless anybody has a question.
I have a follow-up to Judge Sleater's question. If you could turn back to plaintiff's affidavit, I believe page 29 of the addendum, which was the page you were focusing on. In paragraph 13, it states that the agreement does not have a one-year term. And then paragraph 16 states that the bond was renewed several times on or before October 4th, 2014. So it is given that those statements in the affidavit, doesn't that provide evidence to support the district court's conclusion that regarding renewal of the bond?
not on summary judgment. It is insufficient, I think, because it conflicts on its face and it conflicts with the evidence that was before the court as to the unsigned renewal. You can say it was renewed, but the document itself shows that it wasn't renewed.
And well, this says on or before October 4th, 2014. So renewed on or renewed several times until on or before October 4th, 2014. And I think the document you were pointing us to had a 2014 date. I can't recall if it was exactly October 14th.
Yes, it was not October 14th. It was January 1st, is the date of the
notary. July 1st, 2014. Okay.
July 1st,
so you're,
yeah.
So you're saying that's inconsistent with the unsigned bond application.
Right. And nothing else was submitted. The presumptively would be a 2012 bond, a 2013 bond, and a 2014. All we have is the 14. And it's not signed. So I think it conflicts. It's certainly not sufficient when viewed in light most favorable to my client to grant summary judgment. But I think it's so damning when they admit that we applied for 1 year. We're not the applicant, we're the indemnitors. So that is the sum total of our agreement.
Counsel, wasn't the annual premium for this $600 or $700?
You know, I have to admit, I'm ignorant as to the price of the bonds, and I didn't go down that road because I don't represent the applicant. We only represented the indemnitors, and so I have to admit ignorance.
But isn't this like any other insurance policy? You pay for the first year, and then when you pay for the second, you've really renewed your policy.
And that is true with regard to the applicant. That is true with regard to Weinerman and Associates. Yes, absolutely. And I'm not defending them and what their obligations might be for sure.
But what your client signed indicated that there would be renewals and continuations of the surety and the like, did it not?
Well, what may be or may not be, I think is not so much before the court on the Tabertine case. We're stuck with the document, and it says we applied for a one-year bond, and that's what the indemnitors agreed to. So I can't say that we're agreeing that what maybe happened in the future. They should have had our counter. I am accustomed to being to have guarantors countersign an extension or a change. We don't even know what the terms were. If the terms may have changed in subsequent bonds, there might have been law changes. There's a lot of different things that could have happened that would ameliorate the obligation of the indemnitors, even if the surety extended the applicant.
Doesn't the indemnity agreement cover any continuation of the bond?
Well,
I'm looking at page 37 of the addendum. The print is very small, but that's my reading of it.
Yeah,
correct me if I'm wrong. Thank you.
Well, I disagree with the assessment that it's a carte blanche, and I disagree with the assumption that there actually was extensions. We don't have them before the court, and we don't even know what the terms of those extensions might have been. There literally is nothing on which to rule except for the one-year bond that was applied for. We have that. That is attached. But what the future terms were, obligations, it's the insurance industry, that there could have been significant modifications to it, and we simply don't know that. And we're being asked to give a blank check and say that until the end of time, we owe. And that's not what the indemnitors applied for.
And Mr. Miller, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Thank you. And counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Jonathan Nelson with Gristel Law Firm PC, appearing on behalf of respondent Old Republic. May it please the court. I'd like to start first by identifying a couple things that I heard from appellant's counsel that I believe to be untrue. The first being, I believe I heard him say, my client did not sue the applicant WA or the indemnitors. Clearly that's not the case. They are the defendants. And in fact, they are now the appellants. So yes, they were sued. The second thing is that I believe I heard him say there is no evidence in the record showing a renewal other than the 2014 unsigned bond plus my client's affidavit sworn under penalty of perjury. That is also completely untrue. So not only did the trial court have the plaintiff's affidavit, they had copies of the payments that my client made to the state of Minnesota pursuant to the bond claims. They had copies of the letters that the state of Minnesota sent to my client making the claims in the bond. The trial court also took judicial notice of the receivership action filed with the Dakota County District Court, referenced in the complaint underlying this action, showing exactly the circumstances of the receivership, why claims in the bond were made, why my client had to make payments out. And in addition to that, the court also had this 2014 notice of cancellation. So yes, there is quite a bit of evidence, both in the form of documents and sworn testimony that was before the court when the trial court ruled on the motions for summary judgment. Now, as to this, the procedural factors of competing motions for summary judgment, appellants can't have it both ways. Either there is not a genuine issue of material fact, or there is. They can't say, well, there isn't if we win, but if plaintiff wins, yeah, there is then. That's simply not supported. By bringing their own motion for summary judgment, they're implicitly agreeing that there's no genuine issue of material fact. And specifically, Mr. Miller said on the record before the trial court, there is no genuine issue of material fact. That's in the record that was provided to the Court of Appeals here as part of the transcript from that proceeding. And I think that puts the proverbial nail in appellant's coffin, so to speak. With respect to the underlying transactions, I repeat what Mr. Miller said. We've both briefed this matter significantly, going into the weeds. And I'll just touch on a couple of the high points here. There was a distinction between the applicant and the indemnitors. I agree with Mr. Miller there. The applicant was Weinerman and Associates, the entity. The indemnitors are the appellants here, Mr. Bugney and Ms. Troutman. And your honors were very correct in pointing out that the agreement that appellants signed states that it applies to all subsequent renewals and continuations of the bond for which Weinerman and Associates applied. And it specifically states that they're joining in the indemnification agreement by way of this paragraph that appears directly above their signature blocks, which notably lack any mention of their title with the applicant, Weinerman and Associates. Whereas if you look at the signature block for the applicant, that does state a title for the individual that signed on behalf of the applicant. And so clearly, my client was being induced to provide this bond, to issue this bond, by having Mr. Bugney and Ms. Troutman, the appellants here, sign this indemnity agreement and agree to join in the indemnity obligations with the applicant, Weinerman and Associates. And so based on the very clear documents that we have and all of the evidence that was supplied to the trial court, my client and I strongly believe the trial court rendered the just and proper outcome here by entering the order that called for judgment to be entered and docketed in favor of my client and against all defendants jointly and severally.
Counsel, I have a question for you. Mr. Miller pointed to the unsigned bond or bond application, I guess it's at addendum 17. What are we to make of that?
That was not supplied to the court by my client. That was supplied by defendants, and specifically appellant defendants, to the court in support of their claim that the bond was not renewed. But notably, as Mr. Miller just conceded during his oral argument, he doesn't know what the applicant, what Weinerman and Associates actually did with respect to the bond. Did they pay the renewal payments? Did they ask for the bond to be renewed? And I can answer those questions. Yes, they did. They absolutely made those payments. They asked for the bond to be renewed. They would not have been able to operate as a debt collection agency had the bond not been in place. And likewise, the state of Minnesota and the receiver that was appointed by the Dakota County District Court would not have looked to my client if there wasn't an active bond in place. Flowing from that, of course, my client would make payments if they're not obligated to make payments.
So does this document create a genuine issue of material fact regarding renewal of the bond?
No.
And if not, why not?
I don't believe that it does. While it's not signed, I don't believe that that matters because there may be a signed copy out there. And furthermore, I don't believe that we need to have a signed copy in the record in order to eliminate any genuine issue of material fact in this matter, because we have this mountain of evidence, which is the notice of cancellation, my client's payments, the state of Minnesota claims on the bond. We have the receivership notes. We have all of these other things that come into play besides the actual signed bond that I don't think that that's necessary for the trial court to look at this and say, there's this mountain of evidence showing that this bond was renewed, was in time, plaintiff honored it for the benefit of the applicant, Weinerman & Associates' former clients, so that they would be made whole as a result of Weinerman & Associates' fraudulent actions.
Can you help clarify something for me? So the bond, there was a notice of cancellation in October. Well, the date of cancellation was October 4th, 2014, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And the payments were made by your company beginning in 2016.
Correct, Your Honor.
So I'm not that familiar with this area. Explain to me why the company is making payments in 2016 after the bond had been canceled in 2014.
Absolutely, Your Honor. So my client's obligations as the surety relate to the time periods that the bond was in effect. And so what the state of Minnesota did as part of the receivership was they looked at and they investigated all of the wrongdoing by the applicant, Weinerman & Associates, and said, this was the amount of wrongdoing. This was the amount of funds that they should have given to their former clients up through October of 2014. And therefore, this is our claim amount on the bond. Do you agree with it, plaintiff Old Republic? And my client analyzes it, investigates it, asks Weinerman & Associates, in addition to Mr. Bugney and Ms. Troutman, because they were indemnitors, sent all of them letters and said, hey, we got these claims from the state of Minnesota. Can you help us investigate this? Do they have merit? Do we need to honor these? And the risk for my client is such that when there is no response, as there was no response in this case from Weinerman & Associates, Ms. Troutman, nor Mr. Bugney, that my client is faced with the risk of having a lawsuit brought against them to honor the bond by the state of Minnesota. In the course thereof, they would have to pay attorney's fees, interest, and costs. And so my client looks at this and says, well, we can't complete our investigation because we're receiving no help from our applicant nor indemnitors. We need to make these payments because this seem like valid claims. And then we'll look to them afterwards to indemnify us per their indemnity agreement. And so that's kind of the process from a high level. But all of these actions from which the claims were made relate to pre-bond cancellation events.
And so in the plaintiff's affidavit, paragraph 16, stating that the bond was renewed several times up until on or before October 4th, 2014, is tied to the date of cancellation. Basically, that affidavit saying the bond was renewed several times up until that time of cancellation, correct?
Correct, Your Honor. The bond with the same bond number was in effect until October 4th, 2014.
Okay, thank you.
Is it true, Mr. Nelson, just to clarify that obviously, number one, your client believed that the bond needed to be renewed annually in order to be in effect?
I believe that my client has a form that they issue with the bond, and they renew it, whether it's renewed and formally signed every year or whether they rely on the language that Your Honor referenced during Mr. Miller's argument of the bond itself, which says that it's in effect until canceled or no longer needed. I don't know the specifics, and much like Mr. Miller, I have to plead ignorance and concede a lack of knowledge on that answer to your question for the most part.
Well, for example, though, the application clearly is a 1 year period, and that's of course what appellant's relying upon because that's the document that they sign. Your client's position is that they agreed to indemnify any renewals of that. Would it not be logical then, as part of a summary judgment, to present those renewals, the documents that renewed it, because otherwise there'd be a question as to whether the indemnification is ongoing because there's a question of whether the bond's ongoing. In other words, for summary judgment, is it sufficient to infer it was renewed because, of course, a surety would not pay? You believe that that sort of evidence is sufficient, that a bond's been renewed, even though there's no document with any signature indicating renewal?
I'll do my best to answer Your Honor's question. I think that without having a signed, a fully executed bond that states it's effective starting July 1, 2014, that the court could have entered summary judgment and that there could be no genuine issue of material fact, because we don't just have the payments that my client made, which, as Your Honor referenced, my argument is absolutely that my client would not be making those payments if they were not obligated to do so. But we also have the claims on the bond. The state of Minnesota isn't going to waste their time paying an employee, an investigator employee, to submit the claims and to draft up all the documents to prove up the claims, and likewise have the receiver appointed by the Dakota County District Court spend time and money doing the same thing if there isn't actually a bond out there that they can look to the surety here, my client, to be made whole. I mean, that.
But just to clarify, are they looking at the same documents we're looking at, and wouldn't that be for a different purpose than summary judgment? In other words, if they tell a surety, we see you have a bond from 2011, so I assume that's still in place, here's our demand, and you pay it, they're happy and they go on with life. But for summary judgment purposes, the indemnifiers would want to know that, well, did this actually get extended so that our obligation is ongoing?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think that you're honing in on the right thing here in terms of, do indemnitors actually know what's going on with the bond and with Weinerman and Associates? And the answer to that is yes, absolutely they do. And as detailed in my client's motion for summary judgment, which was part of the record, obviously, before the trial court, both appellants here, Mr. Bugney and Ms. Troutman, own significant portions of Weinerman and Associates and were, in fact, officers of the entity. So they were very in the weeds of what was going on, whether Weinerman and Associates was still operating, whether it was still paying these bond renewals, whether it still needed the bond out there. And in fact, when the Weinerman and Associates was wound up, they had knowledge of that as well. And that's detailed in the addendum that appellants submitted, showing that they had very specific knowledge of what Weinerman and Associates' business activities were, including when it wound down, because they were owners and officers.
Doesn't look like there's other questions. If you want to wrap up your response, you may do so, Mr. Nelson. Then I'll turn it over to Mr. Miller.
Judge Kirk, do you have a question?
I did. I didn't unmute myself. I'm sorry. Isn't it true that their signatures, their original signatures, listed their address as the address of the company, not their home addresses?
On the indemnity agreement, Your Honor?
Yes.
I believe so. I believe that is the business address there, but it doesn't ask for a business address. It just asks for an address. And so that was up to them to where they wanted the notices to be sent. And so that was for the purpose of, if there was a claim on the bond, which there was here, that's where the correspondence would have been sent to, until and unless there was an undeliverable notification. Then my client would have looked for a more recent address so that they could get in touch with the indemnitors.
But the address shows how intertwined with the business they were at the time.
I believe so, Your Honor. I believe it shows that, and it was, again, their choice to pick the business's address to have these notices sent to, as opposed to a different address. But it is undisputed, I believe, by appellants that they were owners of Weinerman & Associates and officers of Weinerman & Associates.
Very well. I'll allow you to conclude if you wish, Mr. Nelson, if there's anything else before we turn it back over to Mr. Miller.
Nothing further. I really appreciate the opportunity to appear before Your Honor and this Court of Appeals panel. My client and I just respectfully request that you affirm the trial court's decision. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Miller, you may now respond. You'll have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Sit closer. So there's a couple of things that Mr. Nelson said that I think are particularly salient, and that related to the documents and the documents control. And these are their documents. If there's issues with regard to the phraseology or the language of these documents, that is Old Republic's issue. They're the plaintiffs. They have to have a clean document that means what they think it means. And there's been a lot of discussion here this afternoon by Mr. Nelson saying, well, the state wouldn't have done this or the state wouldn't have done that if thus and such. But that's not evidence. That is not evidence before the court. The fact of the matter is there was an amount paid on the surety. For what period of time, it isn't clear, but there was an amount paid. Weinerman and Associates may owe something, but none of that is our concern. Our only concern is the agreement, and that is the document signed by the indemnity. So if that document doesn't say exactly what Old Republic wants it to say, and they want to bring in evidence as to what the state looked at and saw or whatever, they're right. They did not produce the document to us that is in the addendum unsigned but notarized. That document is a document they produced to the state to try to remedy this matter with the state. We received it from the state. We did not get it from Old Republic. And frankly, I see why they wouldn't produce a notarized but unsigned document. But we didn't get it from them. We got it from the state. Why the state thought that the bond was still in place, that's not material. If they would have examined that, maybe they looked at it too and said, yikes, maybe we have a bond, maybe we don't. And they demanded payment and the surety paid it. But that's not the indemnitor's concern. We're stuck with our agreement. And what we applied for is clearly a one-year bond.
And Mr. Miller, let's talk about that a little more, because the application references a year, but the actual bond itself on A39, and I believe Judge Sleater quoted this language earlier, states that the bond becomes effective on July 1, 2011 and shall remain in effect until the earlier of the expiration of principal's license as a collection agency or the cancellation of bond by the surety. So it's not by its terms limited to 1 year. Would you agree with that?
No, I wouldn't agree with that, because they admit it in their affidavit that it had to be renewed each year. And if it didn't, it was in no effect. Now that's their language referring to their bond. And this language conflicts on its face with the application.
So, but isn't the bond itself controlling in that instance? I mean, what case law can you cite to that would suggest that we would look to the application for the term of the bond rather than the language of the bond itself?
Well, I think that it's the Travertine case that we cited that says, you know, you have to look at the agreement on the face. If you look at their affidavit that was submitted, they refer to the application as the agreement. They don't refer to the bond as the agreement. They refer to the application as the agreement. That's the only thing signed by the indemnitors. That's the only thing that governs the relationship between the surety and the indemnitors. The bond governs the relationship between the surety and the applicant, Weinerman and Associates. And counsel said earlier that I may have misspoke. What I meant to say that they didn't sue the principal of Weinerman Associates. Weinerman Associates is clearly a defendant in this case. So if I said that, I didn't mean that. But the two other shareholders in the company, the minor shareholders, are the indemnitors, and they applied for 1 year. And to the extent that there was an extension of that time with the applicant, we didn't sign that. That is not a part of our agreement. And so at the end of the day, when they admit that it had to be renewed or it would not be of any effect, and that's the evidence before this court, and it was not renewed, there's no evidence of renewal. Now the state demanded payment. Of course, the state demanded payment. That's not evidence that the bond was valid. What is evidence as to whether there was renewal is the addendum that shows the unsigned document. And we didn't get that from them. We got that from the state, where they had submitted it to the state to demonstrate their claims. And why the state didn't look at it and say the same thing that every other lawyer that looks at a document that's notarized but not signed, I mean, that's, we're just back in robo signing again, and that can't be upheld by the court. It's not sufficient evidence.
Thank you to both counsel. We appreciate your briefing and your answers to our questions today. We will be taking the matter under advisement, issue a ruling in the statutory time period. This adjourns this matter. You each have a good day. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Your Honor.